represents a pattern of U.S. imperial behavior. There are certain interests that are declared but never defined, and then the U.S. has to defend those interests.
This morning on Tell Somebody, Alternative Radio's David Barsamian talks about Syria.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
This is Greg Palast, author of Vulture's Picnic, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, your weapon of mass instruction in the beating heart of America.
Hello and welcome to Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now. This is your host, Tom Clammer. Comments or questions on the show, drop us a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. That's mail@tellsomebody.us. We'll get to David Barsamian in just a minute, but first, the podcast of last week's edition of Tell Somebody with investigative journalist Greg Palast on Larry Summers, favored to be the next head of the Federal Reserve, and the secret endgame memo sent to him in 1997 by Timothy Geithner has been posted. Look for links to past shows at tellsomebody.us by clicking on a tile. American Friends Service Committee, Kansas City, has an event posted on Facebook, Demonstration, No U.S. Military Intervention in Syria, and that will be today, this evening, 5 p.m. until 6:30 p.m., 47th and Main Street in Kansas City, Missouri. Reading now from the AFSC Facebook posting, while we unequivocally condemn any use of chemical weapons, along with continued indiscriminate killing of civilians and other violations of international humanitarian law, military strikes are not the answer. U.S. military action will only escalate the fighting, increase the suffering, and delay the necessary diplomatic and political solution. The only thing that can stop the civil war, close quote. At a Senate hearing on Syria on Tuesday, Secretary of State John Kerry said, "Our understanding of what has already happened in Syria is grounded in facts, informed by conscience, and guided by common sense." In a post at consortiumnews.com headlined, "Should we fall again for Trust Me," Ray McGovern writes, in a dazzling display of chutzpah, the White House is demanding that Congress demonstrate blind trust in a U.S. intelligence establishment headed by James Clapper, a self-confessed perjurer. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday voted to give President Barack Obama the power to launch a military attack to punish Syria for using chemical weapons. The full Senate could vote as early as next Monday. I contacted Alternative Radio's David Barsamian to get his views on some of this. Reading from his bio at alternativeradio.org, one of America's most tireless and wide-ranging investigative journalists, David Barsamian has altered the independent media landscape, both with his weekly radio show, Alternative Radio, now in its 28th year, and his books with Noam Chomsky, Iqbal Ahmad, Howard Zinn, Tariq Ali, Arundhati Roy, and Edward Said. His latest book of interviews with Noam Chomsky is Power Systems, Conversations on Global Democratic Uprisings and the New Challenges to U.S. Empire. His best-selling books with Chomsky have been translated into many languages. Barsamian was deported from India in 2011 due to his work on Kashmir and other revolts, as he told us on Tell Somebody immediately after his return home. He lectures on world affairs, imperialism, the state of journalism, censorship, the economic crisis, and global rebellions. He is winner of the Media Education Award, the ACLU's Upton Sinclair Award for Independent Journalism, and the Cultural Freedom Fellowship from the Lannan Foundation. The Institute for Alternative Journalism named him one of its top 10 media heroes. I called David at his home in Boulder, Colorado, and recorded this conversation. Give a listen. David Barsamian, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thank you so much, Tom, and you know that your program, Tell Somebody, is I think, one of the best of its kind in the country. So thanks to you and to KKFI.
Well, thank you so much, and if it is that, it's because of great guests like this morning. But if we've learned anything from Bay of Pigs, from Yellowcake and WMD and mushroom clouds in Iraq, it's that we really cannot take any administration or the media at face value. We have to be a little skeptical. But with this business in Syria, I don't even know where to start. What should we make of this pending action in Syria?
Well, I think I'd like to give your listeners a little bit about the historical background of Syria. And it's a country that I'm particularly tied to. I have friends there. I've been there multiple times. And it's a country that welcomed the Armenians who fled a genocide in Turkey in 1915, and it was Syrian Arabs that saved my mother's life. So, you know, it's not, for me, it's not an ordinary country. It's an extraordinary country. It's a tapestry of people. It's a mosaic of cultures. The population is about 20 million, and the largest group, and overwhelmingly Arab, except for the Armenian population that I mentioned, which is mostly concentrated in the two big cities of the country, the capital, Damascus, and the largest city of Syria, which is Aleppo. Even though Damascus is the capital, Aleppo is very much the business center of Syria, and it's near the Turkish border. And there are Sunni Arabs, there are Alawite Arabs, Alawites being a Shia sect. These are the two main divisions in Islam: Sunni, which is overwhelmingly predominant throughout the Islamic world from Morocco to the Philippines, and then the Shia are a minority within Islam. It's kind of like a Protestant Roman Catholic type of divide. And the Alawites, the Alawis, it derives from Ali, who is the kind of the patron saint of Shia Islam. So the followers of Ali are Alawi, and Alawites in English. The country has been ruled by the Assad family since the early 1970s. Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father, seized power in a military coup and ruled the country right through the year 2000 when he died, and his son, Bashar al-Assad, took over. And I think, you know, having that little bit of a background, the country borders Israel, Lebanon, Iraq, Turkey. And so it's very strategically located in the Middle East. It doesn't have a lot of oil wealth, but it is a kind of a crossroads, particularly in terms of the economy. Now, in the so-called I don't like to use this media-generated term, Arab Spring. When the first uprising occurred in December of 2010 in Tunisia, and then spread almost immediately to Egypt, to Libya, and other states, Syria was a little late in the uprising. It started seeing demonstrations in March of 2011. And those demonstrations were totally nonviolent and peaceful, but were met with violent response from state security forces. And as we saw with in the case of Egypt, one thing led to another, and within months, there was almost a full-scale civil war. Now, even the term civil war is a little misleading, like Arab Spring, so I want to caution people, you know, when they hear this term, to put it in context, because there are various proxy wars being fought in Syria. Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Bahrain and some of these extremely reactionary Gulf monarchies that are, you know, laden with oil wealth, they have been funding jihadi groups like al-Nusra in Syria to overthrow the Alawite regime, the Shia government of Bashar al-Assad. It also, in a way, not just because of their hostility toward Shia Islam, but also to weaken Iran. Iran is a very close ally. Iran, too, is a Shia-predominant country, as is neighboring Iraq. The Shia in Syria, I should point out, only constitute 15% of the population. And there are large numbers of Sunnis that support the government of Bashar al-Assad. The business elite has many, many Sunni members, as does the merchant class. So, you know, so that's part of this background, you know, so-called civil war, sectarianism, and now, of course, military action is being contemplated by the United States. I should say here, too, further military action is contemplated by the United States, because the United States has hundreds of troops in Jordan training fighters who then go into Syria to combat Bashar al-Assad's armies. So you have Turkey has interests in Syria. Iran has interests. Iran has also, one should say, provided logistical support to Bashar al-Assad, and the U.S., of course, is involved. The War Secretary Hagel, who testifies, and along, it's ironic that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has heard testimony from two former Vietnam veterans, Chuck Hagel, and who's the Secretary of Defense, the War Secretary, and Secretary of State John Kerry. These are two decorated Vietnam War veterans, and you think they would be a little cautious in advocating military action. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And so I think, you know, all of these factors in Syria, Syria is a battleground not just for resolving internal conflicts, but also a regional battleground and an international battleground, because the U.S. is involved, Russia, which can't do very much except veto resolutions in the Security Council, is also another part of this equation. I just wanted to give you all of that kind of background. Did that prompt any questions?
Oh, a couple of dozen. One, Syria has a bit of Mediterranean coast, and
there's a Russian naval base in Latakia, which is right on the Mediterranean. I haven't been to Latakia, I've been near it. And this is also an area where the population is predominantly Christian and Alawite. So it's, and the Assad family comes from Latakia.
Uh-huh. So we have some relics of the Cold War with the Soviet Union in the history of all this, right?
Indeed. The Soviets had, long supported the regime of Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, and then has continued that support during this particular period with Bashar al-Assad, and I remember he was not, the first choice. He was not his father's first choice to succeed him. The first choice was another son who was killed in an auto accident. Bashar is a London-trained ophthalmologist, was not known to be heavily involved in politics. But after the death of his brother, he became the heir apparent. And in a very, just like the Gulf monarchies, they just succeed themselves. These are family-run dynasties. And I'm talking about post-colonial states that have broken away. Syria was a French colony. And before that, it was a Turkish colony for literally centuries. So that's some of that kind of colonial background as well.
So what are we to make of President Obama's asserted reasons why we have to
make strike? Well, he declared some months ago that the use of chemical weapons would constitute a red line and would justify, provoke, enable a U.S. military response. I know there's been some controversy, was in fact who used these chemical weapons, where did they come from. But let's concede the point. Let's say that the UN and French and other reports are accurate, and it was government forces that used chemical weapons. How is the use of chemical weapons by Syria any different from the use of chemical weapons by Israel, or for that matter, the United States of America, which used white phosphorus in Fallujah, used depleted uranium throughout Iraq, not just in the war of 2003, but also in the first Gulf War of 1991. So there seems to be a little bit of hypocrisy here at work. I know that's hard to imagine a powerful state engaging in hypocrisy, but that's exactly the case. And if you go further back into history, not that far back, to Indochina, chemical weapons were used against Vietnam, the notorious Agent Orange, which is still having an enormous medical and humanitarian impact on Vietnamese decades later.
Well, and I must confess, I could not help thinking of Fallujah and white phosphorus and a little substitution game when I read a transcript of John Kerry's remarks on why we have to act because of what was done. But
yes, and Kerry, in a very manipulative way, has invoked the Munich analogy, which, U.S. politicians love to fall back on the Munich analogy, saying that, this particular crisis, you can take any crisis, is very much like what faced the so-called democracies when Hitler confronted them at Munich. Were the democracies going to stand up to the dictator, or were they going to appease the dictator? So the kind of structure that's created here is that the adversary, in this case, Bashar al-Assad, is immediately equated with Adolf Hitler. The country Syria, which is a very minor military power, by the way, is immediately analogous to Nazi Germany. So you have that kind of, rhetoric in the background. You have an extreme right-wing Republican leader in the House, Evan Cantor, who invokes another kind of reason to intervene, and that is compelling national interests. That's a direct quote. what these national interests are in Syria or in the Middle East are not spelled out. One wonders, does it have to do with oil? Does it have to do with the alliance with Israel? What are these national interests that are constantly invoked in order to justify intervention and an enormous military presence? You know, before we went on the air, we were talking about the growth of dead-end jobs in the fast food industry, or, you know, greeters at Walmart and Target, and those are the kinds of jobs the American economy is producing, except in the military sector, which is very capital intensive and not labor intensive. An enormous amount of money is going to, just to give you an example, Hagel said, I have, you know, at the president's request, I have deployed U.S. Warships off the coast of Syria. Do you have any idea how many tens of millions of dollars a simple action like that involves? The costs in jet fuel, diesel fuel, the salaries, you know, of the military personnel and the like in doing such a thing. And here on the home front, you know, people are being their lives, their security, their savings are being gutted. And they're being faced with, if they're able to get a job at all, with one that pays below poverty line wages. So I think we should make those connections when we're talking about an interventionist militaristic foreign policy, when the state cannot even provide properly for its own citizens. You know, as you know, I live in Boulder, Colorado. It's a pretty upscale area of the country. Every day, when I bike to my office, I see people coming out of the bushes where they've spent the night, you know, either on cardboard or in sleeping bags or on blankets. You know, that's what's going on here in the homeland, that, you know, our political class is always extolling and talking about, you know, what we're doing for the people here. But, you know, the government is doing very little for people here in need. Now, I know that's a bit of a digression, but as we are poised on yet another U.S. military intervention, I think we should keep in mind the enormous waste and sinkhole that the Pentagon represents in the almost $1 trillion military budget, when people here, you know, don't have proper housing, don't have proper health care, can't have access to education. If they have access to higher education, they go in debt for many, many years. There's so much work to be done here in the United States, and it's just heartbreaking to see the amount of money being spent on militarism and the military-industrial complex.
Well, and your reference to homeless people sleeping in the bushes, we're solving that. There seems to be a wave of new laws in cities across the country outlawing feeding the homeless, outlawing sleeping in public, and so forth. But
yeah, you know, that's absolutely true. Another argument that's being made now, you see, when all else fails, they've got one fallback argument that they constantly go back to, and that is credibility. Now, this is it's a curious word, you know, credibility. You know, what does it mean? The president, you know, drew a red line. If the U.S. does not act, the U.S. will lose credibility. Let's concede again that there is such a thing as credibility. My response to that would be, so what? So the U.S., you know, does nothing. What harm ensues from that? Well, we're told immediately by hawks like McCain and Lindsey Graham, who somehow conduct U.S. foreign policy on their own. You know, they make trips to the Middle East and then come back with prognoses and nostrums as to what needs to be done. What about this particular issue and of credibility? We will seem to be weak. it will send a message to Iran. Now, all of a sudden, they're bringing Iran into the discussion. So if the U.S. doesn't bomb Syria, we're told, this will encourage Tehran to further develop its nuclear weapons. In fact, that's an embedded argument that is made. It's an embedded assertion that is made that Iran is, in fact, developing nuclear weapons. There is no evidence for that. They are enhancing uranium for the peaceful uses of atomic energy according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty to which they are signatories. But now, you know, we're getting a little bit off track here, but these notions of credibility and appearing weak are going to be used over and over again, not just in this military action, but in future military actions as well. Because I think what you and your listeners need to understand is this represents a pattern of U.S. imperial behavior. There are certain interests that are declared but never defined, and then the U.S. has to defend those interests by military means or political diplomatic means or using sanctions, like sanctions and embargoes against Iran, against Cuba, against any country that says no to Washington. So that's you see this kind of pattern being repeated over and over again, and the media are so horrible in this country. They provide no context, no background, no history, and as Howard Zinn used to say, you know, if you don't know any history, it's like you were born yesterday. So Obama can, you know, or McCain or Lindsey Graham or Kerry or Hagel can declare that, you know, a certain portion of the world is of a vital national security interest to the United States and must be defended by military means. And so this circle just keeps going round and round. And the citizenry are paying an enormous price here. And, of course, on the other end of the guns, the damage done to Iraqis, Pakistanis, Somalis, Yemenis, all of whom we are attacking right now as we speak, is immeasurable.
Yeah, and in fact, I've got a quote right handy here. One of the risks of doing nothing in response to the alleged large-scale attacks of August 21st on the people of East Ghouta, Secretary John Kerry said, is that, quote, Iran, which itself has been a victim of chemical weapons attacks, will now feel emboldened in the absence of action to obtain nuclear weapons, close quote. And as you pointed out, there's no hard evidence that they are trying to develop nuclear weapons. In fact, as Ray McGovern has pointed out on this show several times, there was a national intelligence estimate in 2007 with the consensus of all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies that they stopped doing this in 2003 and haven't started again. And this has been reiterated by these agencies, I believe, yearly since then. But, and as far as credibility, talking about the Iran being a victim of gas attacks in the past, there's some U.S. history involved in that too, isn't there?
Indeed, there is. First off, Iraq attacked Iran in a blatant violation of international law in 1980. The war lasted 8 years. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians were killed. Many were killed by poison gas, by mustard gas, sarin, that Saddam Hussein was able to fabricate through loans as well as agricultural subsidies from the United States, from other European countries that were supporting Iraq during that war. So there was this is another perfect example of the double standards that if you care to look at, simply jump out of the pages of history at you. Iran is clearly invaded by Iraq. The U.S. does not go to the Security Council to condemn Iraq for blatant aggression, as it would a decade later when Iraq invaded Kuwait in another type of aggression. So it depends completely on who is breaking international law at what time. When it favors U.S. interests, then the cheek is turned, eyes are averted from the fact. When it is seen as hostile to U.S. interests, such as when Saddam Hussein's Iraq invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, then all hell breaks loose, international law is invoked, the Security Council is convened, resolutions are passed, and, we're told that, the free world has to act. In 1987, Saddam Hussein used poison gas, which was dropped on a Kurdish population in Halabja, dropped from U.S. helicopters, which Donald Rumsfeld supplied to Saddam Hussein when he went to Iraq as Ronald Reagan's special envoy in 1983, dropped from those helicopters, killing over 5,000 Iraqi citizens of Kurdish descent. What was the U.S. response at the time? I don't know if you recall.
I don't, right off.
It condemned Iran. It blamed Iran. The
wow.
State Department said the Iranians are behind this because it was Halabja is near the Iranian border. But in fact, it was the regime the U.S. was supporting, Saddam Hussein. Nothing happened. In fact, the U.S. increased its support after the Halabja, catastrophe. So, again, double standards, hypocrisy, lack of any historical context, all categorize the way the media project what's going on in the Middle East. Now, we should look also, what has happened since the Libyan intervention. There we were told that, military action was required to prevent the genocide. Again, this term is used very promiscuously. In instances when there is actual genocide, such as the case with my own background, the Armenians, the U.S. government refuses to recognize it. And the Turkish government, which committed the acts, denies it entirely. So in the cases when there's actual genocide, it's denied. When there is no genocide, the term is injected into the political discourse in order to justify military action. And they've also created a new term, to go along with humanitarian intervention. Now it's responsibility to protect. There is no such thing in international law about responsibility to protect. Let's say there's a war breaks out between Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas. And Cambodia says, well, people are being slain there in a very brutal way. We're going to send the Cambodian army to sort this out as a responsibility to protect the citizens of Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri. I think you and your listeners might find that really odd, but that's exactly what the U.S. did and is doing and has done, in Libya and elsewhere. In the Balkans, it did that as well. So in every state where there has been uprisings in the Arab Middle East, it has not really gone the way the U.S. had thought it would go. They wanted, there was rhetorically the support for democracy. But what the U.S. wants, I mean, when I say the U.S., I don't mean you and your listeners or me. I mean Washington and the military-industrial complex and the corporations. What they want in power are obedient rulers, people who will acquiesce to and obey Washington's diktats. Now, they can be an Islamist, they can be an anti-Islamist, they can be, you know, any shade of political coloring across the spectrum. The important thing is obedience to Washington's demands. Look at the way the U.S. is talking about Egypt. It hardly talks at all about the Egyptian people. Its greatest concerns is maintaining the peace treaty with Egypt, is maintaining military weapon sales to the Egyptian military, which is a huge economic player inside of Egypt. And that's it. You know, what about the people there? There's not that much concern. Also, they want, you know, access to the Suez Canal. U.S. warships are given privileged status entering the Suez Canal. So if there's, you know, there's literally a backlog. You know, there's a line of ships waiting to go in. The U.S. warships are given priority, so they jump to the head of the queue. The same thing with military overflights. Egypt is a huge country, and the U.S., when it's, you know, bombing Yemen or Pakistan or other countries, and soon, I suspect, Syria, needs those overflight privileges. So those are the things that concern the U.S. and Egypt, not the plight of the Egyptian people. Now, you know, to get back to Syria, the possibility that this war will continue and there will be more refugees in addition to the 2 million refugees already created by this conflict. But I think the U.S. is in a position to exert enormous pressure on its second most favored ally. Of course, Israel is the most favored ally, and that is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is bankrolling jihadi groups, people who want to destroy the Alawite and other minorities in Syria. Literally, they regard them as non-Muslims, and, you know, have said that they want to eliminate them. I mean, you can read there very clearly genocidal language. You know, when groups or individuals start talking about eliminating and taking people out, that is the language of genocide and mass murder. The U.S. could, you know, turn the screws on Riyadh and say, hey, back off. You know, these are some of the most reactionary jihadis anywhere. In fact, many jihadis have gone from Pakistan. I read the Pakistani newspapers, and there were reports of, hundreds of Pakistanis going to Syria and fighting in this jihad. These are the same mujahideen, the same holy warriors that ripped Afghanistan to pieces and that is ripping Pakistan to pieces today.
Well, and you maybe partially answered my next question. Even the administration doesn't, I don't believe, try to claim that this is really going to fix much of anything. The biggest claim they seem to make is again on the credibility, and that it might deter somebody else from using chemical weapons if there's a consequence for it, supposedly. And, you know, I think there are problems with those arguments, but what could the U.S. do besides what you've just said if it really was interested?
Very clearly, instead of dropping bombs, they should be dropping food and water on the Syrian people. They should be supplying those refugee camps with, humanitarian aid and very generous amounts of humanitarian aid. And the people are suffering terribly. And I can't tell you how unimaginably hot it is, although you're in Missouri and Kansas where you have, 100 degree days. Well, there it's, 105, 110, even 115, in desert-like, conditions, and people don't have access, to water. So that's something very practical, that the U.S. can do, and it should promote, negotiations, because that is the only solution, to this crisis. Otherwise, the war will drag on. It dragged on in Lebanon for 15 years before, the warring parties were just spent from exhaustion and signed a peace in 1990. We don't want to see that happen In Syria, a country much larger than Lebanon, the consequences for the entire region, I think, are very, very serious if this war is allowed to drag on. It could devolve into generalized Sunni Shia civil war, sectarian war across Iraq, across parts of Iran, across Lebanon and Syria, and, you know, other countries that have different ethnic and religious groupings within its within their borders. So it's a, I think, promoting a Geneva or wherever they want to meet style negotiations is, you know, absolutely critical, and some kind of temporary ceasefire to be put in place. And here the Russians and Chinese can play a very crucial role where a ceasefire can be called, people who are wounded and can be tended to, medicines can be delivered to clinics and hospitals. That's another huge problem that exists in Syria, is the interruption of medical services. And when you have battlefield wounds, gunshot wounds, artillery wounds, etc., these are, you know, extremely catastrophic and require a high degree of not just medical expertise, which I'm confident Syria has. Syria has a very developed medical profession, but equipment is compromised. There's no there's no electricity, and there's not enough medicine. So that those are some of the things in the short term. If a ceasefire can be called, even for 10 or 15 days, to allow refugees to move about, to allow for the resupply of medical equipment as well as medicine to the various clinics and hospitals, you know, all over the country, that I think will have a very salutary effect. But to go from there, we need to go to negotiations, and who, you know, who is willing to sit down, and what will, you know, what will be the talking points. You know, Assad has indicated he will not step down from power. I personally think, you know, he's made an enormous error in judgment when he reacted violently to those demonstrations in March of 2011, and has, you know, I've been, as I said, I've been in Syria. I know what it's like. I've been followed by the secret police. They were quite inept, I must say, almost laughing. It was almost like a, you know, a farce out of some, you know, B-grade Hollywood movie. That was so obvious that they were following me, these guys in suits, you know. But, you know, Syria is a totalitarian state. It is, you know, it has very little internal freedoms. It is, you know, dominated by this a business class that has benefited enormously from its alliance with the Assad family. And so, you know, those are issues that the Syrian people have to work out, not from Saudi Arabia, not from Qatar and Bahrain and from the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, you know, which are all funding the opposition, both not just financially, but militarily and diplomatically. You know, those are things that the Syrians need to work out, but they can't work things out, you know, when the house is on fire. Your main concern is putting the house, you know, putting those flames out. Once the flames are extinguished, then talks can begin.
Yes, and the conventional wisdom seems to be that because of the UN Security Council, China and Russia will veto anything we try to do, but that seems to always end up being framed within the only thing we want to do is some kind of military action.
Yes, and, you know, I would like to, you know, quote the words of the great Howard Zinn. He said, we would like the United States to be a humanitarian superpower, not a military superpower. So with our wealth we can really have an enormous impact and save people's lives. I mean, that's what's at stake right now. So many children, their lives are in the balance right now. You know, Jackson Brown had a song during the 80s about Central America, lives in the balance. There are so many lives in the balance right now. And in this summer heat, you know, children dehydrating and old people dehydrating and succumbing to various illnesses simply because of lack of water and or medicine.
It seems like the talk from the administration and its supporters is about the danger of doing nothing, even though their own claims of what they plan to do don't seem like they're going to help much. Should we be concerned of sparking some broader problems with this action or with inaction that goes through the whole Arab world, or is that just a little paranoid?
No, I think it's you know, it's a very fragile situation. And so I just use this metaphor of a house being on fire. When a house is on fire, do you put more gasoline on it to extinguish the flames, or do you use water? And so a military attack, and they're saying, you know, again, as we've heard so many times in the attack in the past, these will be precision targeted attacks. They will be precise, you know, using smart weapons. Well, you know, the Syrians are not stupid. They have, you know, moved all of their military and much of their equipment. I mean, they can't move bases en masse into civilian areas. So, you know, what is the nature of this military attack, which without UN Security Council, without UN approval, is illegal under international law and would constitute a war crime, because this is an act of aggression against a member state of the United Nations. We shouldn't forget that.
Yeah, even with Obama surprising many by going to ask for congressional approval, it's still illegal under international law unless the Security Council okays it, right?
Yes, there's no question about that. That's totally unambiguous that this would be a violation of international law. Once again, the country that invokes the term international law will be violating international law. And, you know, and to go back to a point I made earlier, you know, it's time that regimes in Washington, and I'm going to use that term, regimes in Washington adhere to international law, not just for others, but for itself, because there's always, you know, one set of rules for the master who sits in Washington, and for the master's servants who sit in other parts of the world, like London, Paris, etc. And there's another set of rules for the servants. So if the servants, you know, serve up a bad meal or a meal that doesn't taste good, then you hear, all of a sudden you hear about international law and this and that, and our values and morality, and you know, here's John Kerry, you know, talking about morality demands that something be done in Syria, that the use of poison gas is a moral obscenity. Well, I can think of a lot of moral obscenities, including millions of people who are homeless in this country. I can think of a lot of moral obscenities when we have so many people who don't have access to proper medicine because they don't have health care, and so they don't practice preventative care. So that, to me, is a moral obscenity. Tens of thousands of Americans die every year because they don't do the simple preventative tests that could, you know, alert doctors that, you know, there's a problem that needs to be attended to. They wind up, many of them wind up in the emergency room, for which incidentally we, the people, pay for, because there's no universal health care that's really comprehensive and effective. And by that time, it's too late. You know, that little bump I had in my neck, well, now it's the size of a grapefruit.
Right. Well, the clock is winding down rapidly, but David Barsamian, any other final thoughts you want to leave with us before we let you go?
Well, I think it's a very crucial moment right now in Syria and the Middle East. You know, I think maybe this is an opportunity. I dare say it's very difficult, but to open up some kind of conversation about Israel and the U.S. alliance with Israel and the billions of dollars that the U.S. You know, generously gives to Israel. There was an interesting thing in, here's another example of propaganda. In the New York Times of September 2nd, there's a photograph of Israeli soldiers, and the caption was really interesting. It said, Israeli soldiers on patrol in the Golan Heights near the Syrian border. Right? That was the caption. Now, there's a little thing missing here. The Golan Heights is Syrian territory. It was seized by Israel in 1967. It was annexed into Israel in 1981. But if you read the New York Times, which is supposed to be our best newspaper, and I think it is, you wouldn't know that. And so, if you don't have any kind of historical background, you think, oh, this is part of Israel, and the Syrian border is somewhere over there. It's not the case at all. So I think, you know, our citizens, listeners to KKFI, we need to be vigilant in the face of propaganda. We have to challenge these terms like national interests that are invoked to force us into military action. When we hear about credibility or appearing to be weak or sending a signal, these are all terms of propaganda, and we need to kind of unpack them. And I think that's what, you know, one thing your program does so effectively, Tom, is to unpack those terms of propaganda, and KKFI, of course. And I hope people will tune into Alternative Radio Wednesday mornings at 9 on KKFI. It's alternativeradio.org, alternativeradio.org.
Long attention span radio at its best. David Barsamian, thank you very much for spending time with us again on Tell Somebody.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Remember, there is a demonstration, no U.S. military intervention in Syria. That's this evening, 5 p.m. until 6:30 p.m. at the J.C. Nichols Fountain, 47th and Main Street in Kansas City, Missouri. For some particularly good pieces on Syria, I'd recommend www.raymcgovern.com, www.consortiumnews.com, and, of course, democracynow.org. Before we close, I bring you a public service announcement from the NSA. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody, and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth, or Facebook, or Twitter, or email list, or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody, or anytime you like, at www.tellsomebody.us.